got. I am the damn paterfamilias.
Now Mama's got a new beau.
Harley here's got a job. Harley's got prospects. He's bona fide. What are you?
You can't marry him.
I can, I am, and I will.
This gentleman bothering you?
Well, you can't marry my wife.
And stay out of the Woolworth.
To get back to his wife and kids, Ulysses Everett McGill would do anything.
Hey, any boy, Smithy Circus.
He's about to get off on the wrong track.
Who elected you leader of this outfit?
Well, Pete, I figured it should be the one with the capacity for abstract thought.
Boys, just stick with me.
Yeah, we're in a tight spot.
Believe me, I got a plan. I can get my wife back and we can get out of here.
Okay, I'm with you fellas.
Ain't you gonna introduce us, Pete?
I've seen him first!
Pete! Them sirens loved him up and turned him into a horny toad.
You two are just dumber than a bag of hammers.
Allow me to introduce myself. Big Dan, Toot Corp.
Hey, what line of work are you in, George?
Come and get me, Captain Bob!
Oh, George, not the livestock.
Wait a minute. Since we've been following your lead, we got nothing but trouble.
You have eluded me
for the last time.
I got the answers. I'm bona fide.
Maybe your friends think I'm just a stranger. I think you know.
George Clooney, John Turturro, Holly Hunter, and John Goodman star in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Audio Describe. Sunday afternoon at 1 on the Recording Library of West Texas Radio's Sunday Movie Matinee.
You ever been with a woman? I gotta get the family farm back before I can start thinking about that.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 42 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
This is Texas Monthly, the national magazine of Texas. Articles and features read by volunteers and staff at the Recording Library of West Texas.
News and Politics, Medicine, by Laura Bell. Illustration by Julia Dufosse. Investing in Rare Diseases. Dallas-based Taysha aims to commercialize groundbreaking gene therapies to benefit its shareholders and desperately ill children. Babies born with spinal muscular atrophy often live brief, heartbreaking lives. They miss key developmental milestones. They cry weakly. They can't roll over. They never sit up on their own or feed themselves. The disease occurs when the body is starved of a protein so vital for movement that it's literally called the survival of motor neuron protein, or SMN. You inherit two copies of the primary gene that codes for that protein, one from each of your parents. If one is flawed, the good one will cover for it, and you may never know you carry a mutation. But about one in every 10,000 kids gets two bad copies. For decades, scientists have dreamed of curing diseases such as spinal muscular atrophy, diseases born of a single genetic glitch, by replacing the flawed gene with a working one. Progress toward this goal has proven excruciatingly slow. Only in recent years have several gene therapies been approved by the FDA. Among those is Zolgensma, a treatment for spinal muscular atrophy from Chicago-area startup Avexis. R.A. Session was an executive at Avexis, commuting to Chicago 4 days a week from his native Dallas, as the company developed Zolgensma. A veteran of both multinational pharmaceutical conglomerates and small biotech, Session told me recently about a boy named Mateo, who visited the AveXis office in 2017. Mateo had been diagnosed in utero with spinal muscular atrophy and treated with an experimental infusion of Zolgensma shortly after birth. "He's throwing blocks against the wall," Session recalled. "He's running. He was like, you know, a crazy two-year-old. And with that disease, he should never have been able to do anything." That day, Session knew he would never again work in any field but gene therapy, which represents the best and possibly only hope for children like Mateo. "You see something like that, you can't go back to conventional therapeutics," he said. "I want people to have the best opportunity to have what I have, which is a healthy, happy, beautiful child." The idea behind gene therapy sounds as straightforward as changing a tire. The reality is exceedingly complex. If you take a typical drug from your medicine cabinet, it's a very small molecule that will travel throughout your whole body, said Dr. Ed Nylon, the chief medical and scientific officer of the National Organization for Rare Disorders. "It's like a drop of water seeping across a paper towel. A gene won't spread like that. A therapeutic gene must reach the exact cells where a given protein is needed. In the case of Zolgensma, primarily motor neurons in the brain and spinal cord, and those cells must produce the right amount of the protein. The most common way to deliver a gene is by packaging it inside a harmless virus. Viruses make their living by slipping inside cells. The gene simply hitches a ride. Conceived of in the 70s, the first gene therapy of this sort wasn't approved by the FDA until 2017, a treatment for a form of inherited blindness. Gene therapies using somewhat different mechanisms to treat types of leukemia and lymphoma have also hit the market, and Zolgensma was approved in 2019. Complicating the drug development process is the financial math, which doesn't favor gene repair. Pharmaceutical companies seek the biggest consumer pools possible. Create a drug for high blood pressure and you've got 100 million potential customers in the U.S. The roughly 7,000 known rare diseases defined by the FDA as those that affect fewer than 200,000 Americans are an iffier financial proposition, which could be why only about 500 of those conditions have any approved treatment. Funding for clinical trials for treatments of rare conditions often falls to the families of patients who turn to lemonade stands, golf tournaments, and crowdfunding platforms to raise millions of dollars. Zolgensma's success may have helped change the industry's calculations. It showed that a treatment for a rare disease could pay off financially. Session helped broker the Swiss pharmaceutical giant Novartis' $8.7 billion purchase of AveXis in 2018, just before the company submitted Zolgensma for FDA approval. Venture capitalists took note. One biotech CEO told MIT Technology Review, "In my mind, the AveXis deal, there is a before and there is an after." Now Session, who left AveXis following the Novartis acquisition, is leading the Dallas-based venture Taysha Gene Therapies, a partnership with the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. The company launched from Session's kitchen table during the COVID-19 pandemic lockdown in April 2020 with $30 million in seed money. Today, it's valued at more than $700 million and has a handful of clinical trials underway. With Taysha, Session hopes to demonstrate on an even bigger scale that gene therapy for rare diseases can pay off in profits for shareholders and in life-saving treatments for kids. Appropriately, for a company devoted to helping children, Sessions' 9-year-old daughter came up with a name. Taisha is a word from the Caddo Nation of Native American tribes, whose territory once included much of what is now Northeast Texas. It means friend or ally. According to some historical accounts, when Spanish explorers first encountered the word Taisha, they heard it as Tejas, which eventually became Texas. Less than 2 years after its founding, Taisha has grown from just a handful of employees to more than 150, with 3 clinical trials ongoing and 2 more on deck. Session 42 has helped run companies from New Jersey to Chicago, but is happy to be home. Sitting in his office on the 14th floor of a shiny new tower off Interstate 35 East near UT Southwestern, he enjoys a view of the downtown skyline and the Trinity River floodway. Fit and affable, he speaks in excited, rapid-fire crescendos. He points out the window and across the river to where he was born, Methodist Dallas Medical Center. Its rooftop cross barely visible through the summer haze. His parents still live in the 60s-era ranch-style house in Oak Cliff, where he was raised. His mother worked at the post office. His father, a welder at General Motors, grew up working in East Texas cotton fields half the year. "I'm one generation removed from a sharecropper, really," Sessions said. His father taught him how fine clothes are the uniform of confidence. Superman has his cape. And instilled in him a fascination with the churn of money through corporations and Wall Street. In 2002, Session earned a degree in finance from the University of North Carolina at Charlotte, which he attended on a soccer scholarship. After getting his MBA from Texas A&M Commerce in 2004, he was courted by a who's who of banks. But he took the one offer he got from a company that made something tangible, Johnson & Johnson. He went to work in 2005 in its pharmaceutical division. "The first week I got there, I went into a couple of meetings. I had no idea what anyone was saying," he said. He began carting a medical dictionary around. "I didn't want to seem like the guy that didn't know what they were talking about." Session grew to love biomedicine along with the business model that transformed laboratory discoveries into commercial drugs. After a stint at J&J, he worked for another international firm, AstraZeneca. Yet he soon realized that big pharma wasn't his passion. He wanted to be closer to patients and to work on drugs that could save lives. So he entered the turbulent world of small biotech, taking a job with a New Jersey company that was developing a treatment for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. He left when it looked like the drug might not work, a frequent reality in the industry, and returned to Dallas to join another biotech company. Eventually, he landed at AveXis and got hooked on gene therapy. Session left AveXis before the FDA green-lighted Zolgensma. The agency stood by its approval even after the company admitted that data in its application had been improperly manipulated. Session said he had no knowledge of the manipulation. In Dallas, looking for a new opportunity on the heels of his AveXis success, Session learned that UT Southwestern had recruited one of the country's gene therapy pioneers, molecular biologist Stephen Gray, to launch a new gene therapy program just a few months earlier. At the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Gray had worked on a promising treatment for a rare condition called giant axonal neuropathy. "Everybody wanted this guy," Session told me. The two men met in June 2018 at UT Southwestern. He basically puts up a slide that says, "These are all the diseases that we're working on," and it was like 30 diseases, Session said. "I'm just looking at this and I'm like, Steve, what are you doing with this? How are you finding it?" Gray was piecing together the research money himself through government grants and the money raised by patients' parents, but drug companies were also interested in investing. Session remembers telling him, "If you partner any one of these out to a big pharma company, you're not going to be able to work on anything else because they're going to suck up all your time. You're going to lose control." He advised Gray and his team to form their own company to commercialize the treatments. Gray had no interest in leaving UT Southwestern, but he liked Session's drive. "Very high energy," he said of Session. "He's very good at figuring out how to get things done." They formed a partnership with the university to share scientific expertise and potential profit. Session took the helm of what would become Taysha. As the world was shutting down amid the pandemic early last year, he gathered an executive team and laid the groundwork for an IPO. "We raised $300 million from my kitchen table, which is crazy," he said. "I took a company public from my kitchen table on Zoom." AveXis helped prove that there can be significant money in rare diseases. The price tag for a Zolgensma infusion is $2.1 million. It's the world's most expensive drug. The gene therapy treating inherited blindness costs $425,000 per eye. The lymphoma treatment costs up to $475,000. Session argues that most patients don't pay that sum because the drug is typically covered by insurance, and that if the one-time treatment cures the disease, it could actually save families money in the long run compared to the costs of ongoing conventional therapies. The Nonprofit Institute for Clinical and Economic Review concurs. At least in cases where the condition is identified in prenatal screening and treated early. Session also points to the economic benefits of children growing into adulthood rather than dying young. Potentially allowing a patient to be a productive member of society, hold a job, get an education, pay taxes, he said, all that value back to society is significantly meaningful. Even so, Nylon of the National Organization for Rare Disorders said that if many more gene therapy drugs reach the market with a Zolgensma-sized sticker shock, the healthcare system could face a reckoning. There will be more and more companies asking for very high prices to make up for the cost of developing a drug for a small group, Nylon said. I think it needs to eventually be a rebalancing that both allows the companies to make enough money that the innovations continue, but balances that with not overburdening the healthcare system. Some experts have said that the U.S. healthcare system needs to rethink its fee-for-service model, which wasn't designed for revolutionary, but breathtakingly expensive, one-off therapies. First, though, more gene therapies need to cross the finish line, and startups such as Taysha could take the burden of funding those efforts off the backs of families. That includes Casey Willoughbyn and her husband, Doug, who have raised more than $1 million in pursuit of a cure for their son, Will. After his birth in 2011, Will seemed like any other baby boy, babbling, smiling, crawling, and eventually walking around their home in McKinney, about 30 miles north of Dallas. But at 2 years old, Will started to stumble often. Doctors weren't initially concerned, but Casey's gut told her something was wrong. Then, one day in 2014, Will fell on the living room floor and couldn't stand back up. Doctors took an MRI and found that his basal ganglia, the brain's command center for motor functions, was deteriorating. He was diagnosed with Leigh syndrome, a condition only a few thousand children worldwide are born with each year. "It was like a nightmare," Casey said, "and I wanted to wake up." Will has a mutation in a gene necessary for the normal functioning of mitochondria, the power plants inside cells. The Willoughbyns asked doctors about gene therapy, but, Casey told me, they said, "No, that's 20 years out. don't waste your time or energy. Just don't even bother. And of course, my husband and I said, no, that is not an option for us. We are going to fight until the end. They set out to raise enough money to fund a trial of a gene therapy drug. Their efforts got a boost in 2018 when their story was featured on the front page of the Dallas Morning News and caught the attention of some Dallas billionaires who opened their wallets. But even that wasn't enough. When Taysha formed last year, Casey said, there was a sense of relief because we didn't have to raise millions and millions and millions of dollars. We can focus on our rare disease child. Yet Taysha's help comes with a trade-off, ceding significant control to the company. A clinical trial for a drug that could help Will, who now uses a wheelchair and a feeding tube, will come on Taysha's schedule. It's unknown when that might happen. If I were in charge, this would have been done months and months ago, Casey said, adding that she understands that the company isn't answering just to parents, but to its shareholders as well. There is another uncertainty. Even once Taysha launches a gene therapy trial for Leigh syndrome, Will might not be included if he doesn't meet the study's criteria for inclusion. For instance, if his condition is seen as too far along for him to benefit from the treatment. Meanwhile, the Wolobins stand by eagerly and anxiously, like so many other parents of children with rare conditions. It's painful, just heartbreaking as a mom, Casey said. All you want is your child to be treated. I want him to have a long, long life, a healthy, happy life. Stephen Gray understands the frustration of families like the Wolobins. I think everybody feels the sense of urgency, he said, but the science has to dictate the pace of progress. Laura Beal, a former Dallas Morning News medical reporter, has also written for Men's Health, the New York Times, and Cosmopolitan.
Travel and Outdoors, Hunting, by Wes Ferguson. Photographs by Trevor Paulhus. Eat, Pray, Love. Reading time, 16 minutes, 30 seconds. A Day in the Woods with the Squirrel Hawkers of East Texas. Of all the red-tailed hawks that have ever soared on a Texas breeze, only one gets to live in Charlie Alville's house, at least during the winter hunting season. My bird has its own bedroom, said Alvis, a falconer who's based in the unincorporated community of Porter, just beyond the northern outskirts of Houston. When I come home at night, that bird comes in the living room with me. We socialize for hours at a time. The 43-year-old Alvis, who's temporarily living in Brownwood in central Texas for work, is long and lean and sports a gray beard. His 5-year-old hawk has a golden chest, dark wings, a fan of reddish tail feathers, and often a murderous glare in her eyes. Alvis acquired the bird from a falconer in Georgia more than 2 years ago. He named her Calypso, but doesn't use it. There's no point, he told me. Hawks respond to whistles and bloody snacks, not noms de guerre. Human and hawk share a certain understanding, though. Alvis can sense any change in the bird's demeanor. I can open the door to her room and tell if she's ready to hunt, he said. Her normally fluffy feathers become slicked back, like a solid suit of body armor. In such moments, she answers an unspoken question. Do you want to kill some squirrels? You know I do, the hawk seems to tell Alvis. Where are we going? The answer, on a cold and bright morning last February, was a big cattle ranch near Livingston, about 50 miles north of Porter. where Alvis and other Falconers from across the state convened for the Texas Hawking Association's third annual Bushytail Bash, an event known to participants as a squirrel hawking meet, which is exactly what it sounds like, a gathering where their hawks hunt squirrels. About 60 falconers and their friends attended the event over a long weekend. It was more social affair than stiff competition. After all, squirrels are the state's least dangerous game. Unlike at other similar hunts, these full days of hawking did not culminate in family-style meals. There were no hunters stirring pots of gamey stew or smothering their chicken-fried squirrels in cream gravy. The falconers had assembled for sport and community, not sustenance. Each morning, they set off in small groups, typically with one bird per party, to scour the ranch's upland timbers and bottomlands for their prey. With Calypso perched on his leather-gloved forearm, Alvis marched into a wooded creek, bottom next to a grassy pasture. Week-old snow from the record-setting winter storm patched the forest floor, and cows bawled in the distance. In less than 10 seconds, the duo spotted their first unlucky victim, a gray squirrel. The hawk launched. She zigzagged through a maze of flora. Alvis sprinted behind her, dodging hardwoods and wild grapevines. When the rodent darted up the tallest oak, the hawk began to hop from limb to limb on surrounding trees, maneuvering into striking position. Then she dive-bombed, exploding through a mass of snapping twigs to snatch her prey. "Oh yeah," Alvis hollered. "You got him." "It usually don't happen this fast," he explained. Maybe not, but it was still breathtaking. A wild and ancient art. Dating back 4,000 years, falconry represents one of the oldest and most enduring relationships between human and bird. It is also perhaps the most romanticized form of hunting. In literature, falcons are forever turning and turning in one gyre or another. Shakespeare peppered his plays with references to raptors. Even today, several of our colloquialisms have roots in falconry, from "under my thumb" and "wrapped around my little finger," which refer to the way falconers hold their birds, to "hoodwinked," after the leather hoods that cover the heads of falcons to keep them calm while they are being transported. The British writer Helen MacDonald found solace in training a goshawk while mourning her late father. "The hawk was everything I wanted to be, solitary, self-possessed, free from grief, and numb to the hurts of human life," she wrote in her acclaimed 2014 memoir, H is for Hawk. Generations of younger readers were introduced to falconry through Frightful, the peregrine plucked from her mother's nest and raised by fictional runaway, Sam Gribble, in My Side of the Mountain, the classic 1959 children's novel. For centuries, from Europe to Arabia to Mongolia, falconry was a sport for nobles and a food-gathering tactic for everyone else. In Texas, it tends to attract a blue-collar set. Anyone with an apprentice permit can trap a bird of prey and train it to hunt. Becoming a full falconer, however, requires at least 2 years of training and passing a test. Hunting with a gun is more convenient and efficient, of course, so falconry is very much a niche pursuit. There are fewer than 400 licensed falconers in Texas, about 10% of the nationwide total. Although eagles can also be trained to hunt with humans, the Texas community is largely divided into two camps: those who hunt with falcons, known as longwings, and those who hunt with hawks. Longwings, most popular among them, the peregrine falcon, are awesomely swift. They can pick off pheasants and ducks mid-flight. Hawks, by comparison, tend to pounce from a perch, catching their prey off guard. "You hunt different game with different birds," explained Corey Rolk, director at large of the Texas Hawking Association. "Just like you would hunt deer with a scoped rifle or quail with a shotgun, you would never use a peregrine falcon to hunt squirrels, and you would never use a redtail to hunt quail." Red-tailed hawks, thought to be the most ubiquitous raptor in Texas, are prized for their versatility. Females are bigger than males, and have thick talons that can't be bitten off easily by larger targets, such as fox squirrels. Another hawk, the harris, is extremely social for a carnivore, with a pleasant demeanor that lends itself to falconry. The harris hawk is the easiest bird in the world to train, Alvis told me. "They're smarter than you are, so they're going to train you." Commonly found in the wild in South and West Texas, where they often hunt in packs, hence their nickname, Wolves of the Sky. Harris hawks also excel at killing rabbits, a pursuit that is sometimes derided by longwing falconers as dirt hawking, for the cloud of dust that tends to arise from a successful catch. Their feathers sufficiently ruffled, dirt hawkers joke that their longwing counterparts are snooty elitists. "They may hold their heads up a little bit higher," said Alvis, "but at the end of the day, we're all falconers." Back at the tall oak tree, Calypso continued to clutch her first victim of the morning. A bell attached to her leg jingled as she swayed and shook in a tangle of branches. "Come on, bring that squirrel down here," Alvis called up to her. "She's just trying to figure out how to work herself loose." "Without accidentally dropping the squirrel," he explained. Alvis blew a whistle and dangled his lure, a second bell on a string with a small piece of meat at the end. Finally, she plummeted to the ground near his feet. When she hears that whistle blowing real loud, that lure swinging around, she knows there's food on that, Alvis said, noting that hawks quickly learn to associate a lure with a snack awaiting their return. "She's gonna come no matter what." He knelt beside her and swiftly killed the squirrel. To distract Calypso, he pulled out a tidbit of raw squirrel meat he'd been keeping in a camo fanny pack and set it on the ground a couple of feet away. The hawk wanted the meat badly, but she didn't want to release the squirrel. She began to whine. "She's stubborn," Alvis said. When he slid a pillowcase over the carcass to hide it from view, Calypso darted for the morsel and gobbled it down. Alvis was careful not to let her eat too much. "This only works because the birds are not starving, but they're hungry," he explained. "A fat hawk sits in a tree all day long and does nothing. If you let your bird eat too much on the ground and try to fly her again, she'll say, 'No, I'm good. I'll go sit over here.'" Trained hawks are still wild creatures after all, with minds of their own. On a full stomach, a hawk could very well fly away. "I gave her enough that she feels like she got rewarded, and she'll be able to hunt some more today," Alvis said. He and the hawk proceeded deeper into the forest, on the lookout for their next kill. Alvis came to a muddy creek. On the other side of the steep bank, a squirrel ran by, rustling the leaves. Ho, ho, ho! Alvis called to the hawk, before crossing the stream on a snow-covered fallen log. Safely on the other side, he continued his pursuit. The squirrel darted up another stately oak. The hawk lunged for the rodent, which scampered to the underside of a limb perhaps 40 feet above the ground, narrowly avoiding capture. Unexpectedly, a wild redtail arrived. Competition. The untamed bird circled the tree, looking for an opening to swoop in and steal the prize. Alvis shouted to scare it away and frenetically tugged at a grapevine, shaking branches in an attempt to knock the squirrel loose. The squirrel leaped, as did Calypso. She couldn't hold on. Ho, ho, ho! Alvis yelled again. Predator and prey plummeted to the ground, the hawk landing talons first directly atop the squirrel. As a reward for her catch, Alvis cut off one of the critter's hind legs. His hawk feasted. Their two kills that morning were the 73rd and 74th squirrels that Alvis and Calypso had taken together, by his estimation. A welder by trade, he supplements his income by working with trained raptors as a bird abatement specialist, shooing seagulls away from trash in landfills. Birds are a part of me now, he said. I'll never not have a bird. Alvis was already an experienced hunter when he became a falconer 7 years ago, during a difficult period in his life. I was dealing with the loss of a child, he said. Alvis's toddler son, Mason, died in 2006 after Alvis and the boy's mother had separated. An autopsy ruled that the cause of death was blunt force trauma to the head, and Mason's common-law stepfather was convicted of the murder and sentenced to 30 years in prison. It probably took me 10 years to process all of that, Alvis reflected. When a friend introduced him to falconry, it became an obsession. I needed something to ground me, give me structure, because I was just running wild, Alvis said. When I got into falconry, I quit drinking. I quit running around partying. This is what I do, and this is what I'm going to keep doing. It changed me as a person. Falconry, Alvis said, is therapy. Keeping a bird of prey is not expensive, he noted, but it is a huge time commitment. In addition to frequently training his hawk, Alvis weighs Calypso every day, sometimes multiple times, to ensure she's maintaining a healthy hunting heft of about 3 pounds. Every squirrel she kills is gradually fed back to her. This is all I think about, Alvis said. Now I wake up in the morning and I think, all right, I need to go check on my bird. What am I going to feed my bird today? Am I going to hunt today? His partnership with hawks has taken him places he never would have gone otherwise. I'm hunting stuff behind Dollar General, he said. I'm hunting in places most people can't even walk through. But we're not walking. She's flying. She's good, doing her thing.
News and Politics, Dispatch, by Christopher Hooks, illustration by Thomas Fuchs. Critical Race Fury. A loud minority of parents is making life miserable for Texas school officials and shouting down the kids who speak in favor of lessons about the history and persistence of racial discrimination. No child is guaranteed success in life, but students in Eanes Independent School District, located in the rolling hills of West Austin, will have an easier time attaining it than many of their peers. The neighborhoods that feed into Eanes are some of the state's richest. All but one of the district's 9 schools won an A rating from the state in 2019. the last time grades were handed out. About 99% of the 2021 senior class at Westlake High School was accepted to college. Superintendent Tom Leonard tells the audience at the June 22nd meeting of Ames Board, recapping another year of high achievement. The robotics team won a state championship, he adds, which could improve the school's third-place standing in the Lone Star Cup. Awarded to the state's winningest schools, Westlake also won a state football championship, and the boys' golf team won state too, as it has 4 years running. By the standards of Texas public schools, Ames is an idol. Soon after Leonard stops speaking, however, loud yelling commences, and it continues for the better part of an hour. According to most of the 38 people who have come to give public testimony, the district schools have become beholden to post-Marxist critical theory, as one speaker puts it, an updated version of Marxism focusing on differences between people. The school board, says another, has opened the doors of Eames to Antifa and BLM, forces that salivate after war and burn down communities. On the agenda today are two items that might seem unlikely reasons to go to battle. One is the contract of Mark Gooden, a professor at the Teachers College at Columbia University in New York City, and since 2020, the diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant for Ames. The second is a rewrite of the district's mission statement. After workshopping the document for more than a year, the board had settled on Unite, Empower, Inspire, every person, every day. In the burst of self-reflection that followed the summer of George Floyd, many districts hired DEI consultants. Gooden, according to Ames board president John Habenstreit, looked at Ames data, met with community stakeholders, and provided recommendations. Schools in Ames did not appear to discipline children of color at a higher rate than white children, as many others do, or place disproportionate numbers of white students in advanced placement courses. Gooden did recommend training for teachers and staff on how to approach racial issues, among other sensitive topics. That didn't happen, for the most part, because of the disruption of the pandemic. But the parents at the June meeting see Gooden's involvement, along with the new mission statement, as evidence that Ames is becoming excessively woke, if not anti-white. Gooden, they say, embraces critical race theory, and by letting him run riot, the whole district has become tainted with it. Before this past year, CRT was a term you'd hear mostly in discussions among academics, especially legal scholars, about the ways in which racism has shaped various institutions and practices in the United States. For example, the redlining of minority neighborhoods, where banks would not make loans. Now it's become a catch-all term encompassing fears that our youth are being taught to hate America through constant recitations of its sins and that whites should be considered irredeemably racist. That the legislature passed multiple laws earlier this year to move to abolish the teaching of critical race theory in schools, as Governor Greg Abbott puts it, has only inflamed those concerns. Why, the parents want to know, does Ames need a diversity program at all? I was raised as a minority in school, one parent says. I'm a Jew, okay? I was the only one in my school most of the time. I'm just fine, by the way. A father says that when he was young, he was told to suck it up when he was bullied. The kids in Ames who have complained of being taunted with racial slurs, he says, should toughen up a bit. Expressing the idea that the diversity program is intended to make white people feel ashamed of being white, one woman reminds the school board members, you guys are all white, and demands to know, are you feeling guilty? The most pointed anger, though, is directed at Havenstreit. Because of the number of people who have asked to speak, he has ruled that each will have 1 minute to hold forth instead of the customary three. Every time he cuts off a member of the public, the crowd shouts, let them speak. This leads to the ugliest moment of the night. After 20 minutes of diatribes from angry adults, a sophomore at Westlake High gets her turn to speak. Increasing diversity education is important in a district that is becoming more diverse, she says. It's important to make clear we're making an active effort to move forward. Before long, her time is up, but she keeps going. The crowd, unhappy with her message, starts jeering. 1 minute, 1 minute, they holler over her. I'm sorry, your time is up, a voice calls out in a mocking tone. If they don't get the time, she doesn't get the time. A nearby woman grabs for the mic, attempting to wrest it away from the student. The room full of ostensible grown-ups drowns out the student. She's choking up as she steps down from the mic. The kids are all right, probably. They usually are. The parents, though. The most bitter and deranging political conflicts invariably involve local politics, often filtered through issues in which very little seems to be at stake. Congress can debate wars that cost trillions and remake entire continents with as much vim and vigor as the mid-morning panel at a morticians' conference, but Americans regularly shoot one another at homeowners' association meetings. It's long been said that all politics is local, but that feels less and less true, especially in Texas. A person can hardly be expected to run for justice of the peace in this state without developing position papers on the various fronts of the culture war. This year, two of the most heated debates in American life, the controversy over CRT and the question of how to live with COVID-19, have converged on school board meetings across Texas. The June skirmish at the Eanes board meeting was one episode in a struggle that has dragged on for a year and a half and which has grown increasingly personal and nasty. Things continue to deteriorate all summer. At the next school board meeting in August, the same folks who vigorously opposed Gooden's contract vigorously contested a requirement eventually instituted by the board that kids in the district wear masks. Then, at a back-to-school event, an Eanes parent ripped a mask off a teacher's face, an incident that became national news. Eanes is one district among many, nationally and statewide, where things have gone off the rails, though thus far in Texas, the school board wars haven't involved militias or threats of physical violence, as they have elsewhere. When Highland Park ISD in Dallas debated mask policy in August, a student testified that he'd feel uncomfortable going back to school if his cohort weren't wearing masks. Adults in attendance shouted him down, yelling sheep and homeschool. In September, furious protesters shut down a meeting of the Round Rock ISD board that had been called to discuss the district's COVID precautions, with some troublemakers having to be forcibly removed by police. At a meeting of Grapevine Colleyville ISD, a former candidate for a seat on the board lambasted the first black principal of Colleyville Heritage High School, James Whitfield, accusing him of believing in the conspiracy theory of systemic racism. Parents and activists demanded Whitfield's termination. The board placed the principal on leave without explanation, chalking it up to a personal issue, and more than 100 students demonstrated in support of him. In a lengthy Facebook post, Whitfield wrote that the blowback wasn't new. District officials had asked him in 2019 to remove a photo of him kissing his wife, who was white from social media because parents had complained. The request, a district official claimed, had absolutely nothing to do with race. Schools and school boards have always been places in which big questions in American life are thrashed out, sometimes to the point of bloodshed. In the 1840s, a conflict between Protestant and Catholic Philadelphians over what version of the Bible should be used in public schools spiraled out of control, culminating in cannon fire and more than a dozen deaths. The Scopes Monkey Trial in 1925 killed only William Jennings Bryan, but marked the end of an epoch in American life. At least once every generation, Texas has seen crusades to kick communists or Chicano activists or other purported wrong thinkers out of the education system. And for more than a century, the state's conservatives have sought to shape curricula and textbooks in public schools to reflect their values and priorities. One of our prominent textbook crusaders, Norma Gabler, urged schools to shy away from the story of Robin Hood, an unrepentant believer in wealth redistribution. But the recent furor is the most intense Texas has seen in a long time, and it's largely directed at school board members who, while elected, are essentially unpaid volunteers. The public ought to understand the kind of pressure that the folks who are trying to make public policy are under right now, says Haven Streit, who got elected before COVID and has watched as the Eanes trustees have become subject to enormous social pressure. Emotionally, it's a strain, he says. I have friendships that may or may not survive. Many school board members in Texas run for office because their children attend school in the district, and as communities have become polarized around issues that come before the board, their kids have been drawn in too. The kids all know who is on which side of the masking issue, and that's really sad, Haven Streit says. Some of the community reaction has crossed boundaries in ways that make Eanes trustees wonder if they're at risk of something more serious. One received a printed-out picture, sent anonymously in the mail, of her daughter at a Westlake football game not wearing a mask. More and more, politics is defined by comparatively small groups of comparatively loud individuals dominating the discourse, when it is unclear whether they speak for anyone but themselves. The school board meetings, degenerating into screaming matches all over the state, often involve, at most, a few dozen angry protesters. Some are not even parents of children in public schools. The cloistering effect of social media gives groups that speak primarily to one another the sense that they represent a silent majority instead of a vocal minority. In Eanes, that frustrated faction takes the form of Eanes Kids First, a private Facebook group in which the angriest folks in the district convene daily to encourage one another and demean those they regard as enemies, teachers, other parents, school staff. When Jennifer Horn Stevens, a former Republican apparatchik and the ad hoc spokesperson for the block of the irate, emails board members, she shares the missive with the group and is lavished with praise for it. "Tell the truth to this community," she wrote on September 17th to trustees at EanesISD.net. In a characteristic note, "Stop these shenanigans. Reports of racism in the district were fake news," she went on, while the school board was promoting books such as "Whiteness is a Bad Thing," she said. "Do your job or resign." The group makes plain the attitudes and anxieties that are driving the furor. "If the board were really serious about equity," writes one member of the group, "they'd give a POC, person of color, from a poor neighborhood their house and expensive cars." Gooden, writes another member, needs to look at countries that are dominated or controlled by POC, African countries, before he calls us oppressive. On July 25th, Corbin Castile, a member of the group and another local Republican activist, posted an ominous letter commenting, "We're next." The letter, originally ostensibly from a group called Dallas Justice Now, was directed toward parents in Highland Park ISD, a district that's as wealthy and high-achieving as Eanes. It admonished white parents for their privilege, earned through oppression, and asked them to pledge that their children would not apply or attend any Ivy League school, or indeed, any university in the top 50 of the U.S. News and World Report rankings. The letter contained an implied threat that any rich cracker so bold as not to sign the pledge would be exposed to the public. The letter caused shock and dismay on Eanes' kids first. "OMG, are we in Cuba now?" said one parent. "This is the definition of Marxism," said another. "What the actual F is this?" wrote Stevens. "Hell no." For a moment, everyone's fears were made manifest. But the letter was a fabrication, written to freak people out. There is no evidence Dallas Justice Now is real, or that its spokesperson, Michelle Washington, is either, though the letter received breathless coverage in right-wing media for weeks. In fact, as the fact-checking site Snopes reported, the group's website was developed with the help of a Utah-based company that consults for Republican politicians. That's a lot of effort to rile up folks who want to be riled up. But these are potent issues, and there's growing institutional support for efforts to take back school boards. In Carroll ISD, a political action committee called South Lake Families raised more than $200,000 in 2020 to support candidates opposed to the school district's DEI initiative. Earlier this year, Stevens ran for a position on the Eanes board, and though she lost, she raised a sum that dwarfed any other campaign the district has seen, upward of $130,000. The threat the loud and the angry pose isn't necessarily that they win outright, but that they tire others out, that they make public service too burdensome, too painful, too tedious. If, then, you think your local elected officials are doing a decent job trying to muddle through a demoralizing and unprecedented period, it might help to let them know, maybe at one of the meetings where they're getting yelled at, "Just get ready to duck."
Meanwhile, over on TexasMonthly.com, on the field with the smallest Texas high school playing football this year, Jeff Miller visits the small, far west Texas town of Del City, whose single K-12 school has just 13 high schoolers, and is playing six-man football for the first time since 2018. But as Coach Joey Chabinski sees it, the team's small school size shouldn't be a crutch. We've got to use that as motivation. A trio of folklorico dancers owns one of Texas's best new taco trucks. Edgar Jepez began selling tamales and working in Austin restaurants to support Ballet Folklorico de Austin, the dance company he founded in 2015. This year, he and two members of his troupe, Luis Fernando Baez and Sonia Lopez, joined forces offstage to start a food truck, Los Danzantes ATX. Jose R. Ralat gives the truck's menu, which nods to the cuisines of each of the owner's hometowns, a standing ovation. Meet the fearless women racing lawnmowers in Texas. The sport might not sound particularly dangerous until you've gotten to know the bruised and intrepid drivers, one of whom suffered broken ribs when a souped-up rig with a Predator engine flipped over a hay bale barricade. Dana Gockman speaks with a handful of women who compete and find community in the male-dominated Lone Star Mower Racing Association. Expert gardening tips with a changing climate, as many Texans learned in the aftermath of February's freeze, as well as from the droughts that are becoming more frequent and severe, designing a garden is getting more challenging. Renowned landscape architect Jim Burnett gives Elena Werfel 6 tips for building a sustainable garden that can be enjoyed year-round, come what may. Has Texas brisket peaked? After Texas Monthly wrapped up taste testing in search of the state's 50 best barbecue joints, see page 88, Daniel Vaughn observed that our favorite smoked meat is now so reliably excellent that preparing great brisket no longer feels like an achievement. He credits Aaron Franklin's 2015 book, Franklin Barbecue, A Meat Smoking Manifesto, for making meaty magnificence attainable. While Democrats and Republicans in the state ledge formed a rare alliance on child welfare, lawmakers overwhelmingly passed a series of measures this year aimed at fixing Texas's long-troubled foster care system, which is facing a capacity crisis and has been the subject of a decade-long lawsuit over its violation of children's rights. Roxana Asgarian details the unlikely allies on the left and right who helped push the reforms, which are geared toward allowing children to remain with parents in situations where poverty is confused with neglect. Scan the QR code to watch a new installment of our Made in Texas video series, in which Philip Morley, who makes custom wood furniture in Wimberley, explains how woodworking was kind of what saved my life.
Thank you for joining us for Texas Monthly, the national magazine of Texas, read by volunteers and staff at the Recording Library of West Texas. You can hear this program on demand with your favorite device at recordinglibrary.org. Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Make Believe Ballroom, followed by the History Book Hour at 9. Here's what's happening on the Armchair Adventure Hour. Starting Wednesday, January 18th, we continue the Little House series with the fourth book, On the Banks of Plum Creek, by Laura Ingalls Wilder. The adventures of Laura and her family continue as they leave their little house on the prairie and travel in their covered wagon to Minnesota. Here, they settle in a little house made of sod beside the banks of beautiful Plum Creek. Soon, Pa builds a wonderful new little house with real glass windows and a hinged door. Laura and her sister Mary go to school, help with the chores, and fish in the creek. At night, everyone listens to the merry music of Pa's fiddle. Misfortunes come in the form of a grasshopper plague and a terrible blizzard, but the Pioneer family works hard together to overcome these troubles. And so continues Laura Ingalls Wilder's beloved story of a pioneer girl and her family. The 9 Little House books have been cherished by generations of readers and listeners as both a unique glimpse into America's frontier past and a heartwarming, unforgettable story. On the Banks of Plum Creek by Laura Ingalls Wilder, starting Wednesday, January 18th. The Armchair Adventure Hour, every night at 10, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 39 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-30s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the mid-50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas, this 24-hour weather center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Good cheer your way. It's make-believe ballroom time. everyone. It's no time to fret, your dial is set for fun. Just close your eyes and visualize in your solitude. Your favorite bands are on the stands, and Mr. Miller puts you in the mood. It's make-believe ballroom time, the hour of sweet romance. Here's your make-believe ballroom. Come on, children, let's dance, let's dance.
Hi, folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the make-believe ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S., as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world, and from coast to coast on public university and community radio stations, welcome, welcome, welcome one and all to the Make-Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing jazz and big band music, and many of the stories behind the records and the personalities who recorded them. I hope you're all having a great day, and as a matter of fact, if you're not having a great day so far, you will be, because I will start spinning discs for this broadcast with Benny Goodman. Sing me a swing song. Sing Me a Swing Song, Benny Goodman and his orchestra, vocal by Helen Ward, recorded on May the 27th, 1936. And come to think of it, if you were ever wondering how long back then it took for a record to go from recording and post-production onto record store shelves, the song was recorded May 27th, 1936, as I mentioned. It was pressed and then released just a couple of weeks later on June the 10th of 1936. So a pretty quick process back then to go from the recording studio to the record store shelf. I vowed a few weeks back to play